going to go ahead and start. We don't have a quorum yet, but hopefully we will as we go along. Today we're going to hear from our two state agencies covered by this committee. There it is. Okay, good. And before we get started, I just want to welcome the ninth grade students from Heritage Christian Academy. Welcome to the committee. We hope you'll have a chance to learn something today about housing and about healthcare. That's what this committee covers. So welcome. I'm glad you're here. I'm going to turn the next announcement over to Christine Murphy, our committee administrator.
Hey, I made bars for everybody, so I'll just take one or pass them around. That's fine.
Thank you, Christine. I think we're going to start a competition here among the staff. So Christine has put out the challenge. Anybody else in the next few days, next few weeks, couple months, want to try to do better? Please feel free. Oh, excuse me. Of course, legislators and staff. In fact, we should start with legislators. Thank you. Okay, so the first we're going to do, we're going to hear from the about the governor's budget from the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. And I believe Jeanette is here to talk with us. And I think members probably have something in their folder. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, good morning. I'm Jeanette Blankenship with Housing Finance, and I'm here today to present the Governor's Supplemental Budget Recommendations for the agency.
Excuse me, could you bring the microphone a little closer? Yeah, there you go.
Tanya and I were double booked, so she sends her regrets, and you get me today.
Great, we're glad you're here.
You should have this in your packet, so okay. I'll kind of follow through it, but won't address every slide directly. Excuse me. First, I'll share with you our principles that we use to guide the recommendations in the supplemental budget, and then give an overview of the recommendations and the rationale for where the reduction came from, and then finally present the impact of the budget reduction on the programs. So in front of you, this packet has slides, including an appendix. I'm not going to go into detail on the appendix items, but we thought it was useful to include a summary of each program, and that the agency administers, and a funding history of the last few years, showing the base budget, one-time funding, reductions, and unallotments. We started the supplemental budget process with the same three principles that we used last year in creating the 2010-2011 budget. We wanted to preserve programs that serve the most vulnerable, such as Bridges and Housing Trust Fund. We know that many of these programs serve Minnesotans with the lowest incomes, and we want to be sure that these are protected. Many of these have disabilities. Without these programs, they really have nowhere to go. Next, we wanted to protect programs that optimize the contributions from non-state resources to affordable housing, such as federal funding. And finally, we wanted to continue progress on the business plan to end long-term homelessness. To these three principles, we added a fourth for the purpose of the supplemental budget: to honor previously made commitments to the maximum extent possible. We have some programs we've committed for both fiscal years 10 and 11, and we didn't want to renege on those commitments. For example, Bridges, which helps folks with mental illness, is already committed for 2010 and 2011. They're anticipating that rental assistance. We don't want to reduce that next year. These existing commitments led us to look at programs that had unobligated funds. In 2009, the base budget for fiscal years 10 and 11 signed into law was $86.768 million. The supplemental budget proposes a 6% reduction to unspent funds in 2010 and a 6% reduction to all funds for 2011. This totals $2.061 million for 2010 and $2.603 million for 2011, for a total base reduction of $4.664 million for fiscal years 10 and 11. This is in addition to the $256,000 unallotment from the rehab program. As of January 31st, 2010, nearly three-quarters of fiscal year 10 funds have been committed, but only 58% of the fiscal year had passed. So we do kind of forward commit a lot of funds and often disperse them on a quarterly basis. The reduction will come from two places. For fiscal year 10, the $2.061 million will come from the Preservation Affordable Rental Investment Fund, or PARIF, as I'll refer to it as. And for fiscal year 2011, $1.603 million will come from PERF, and another $1 million will come from the Rehabilitation Loan Program. The PERF program provides below market rate interest deferred loans to help cover the costs of preserving affordable rental housing. This preserved housing is special in that it has long-term project-based federal subsidies, and the state is in jeopardy of losing those subsidies because contracts are due to expire. So we use PERF to help preserve housing that's in pretty much the project-based Section 8 portfolio. The Rental Rehabilitation Program provides interest-free deferred loans for affordable rental housing to make needed health and safety repairs to the property. With the supplemental budget reduction and unallotment, the available funding for Minnesota housing in fiscal years 10 and 11 is now $81.6 million. Now I'll tell you about the rationale for taking from PERF and rental rehab loan. First, last year we received word that new federal guidelines for elevators would dramatically increase the cost per unit for rehabilitating properties that have federal assistance, such as these project-based Section 8 properties. The actual data is now coming in a year later, and the real cost is much lower than anticipated. So our per unit cost is lower than we thought because the cost for elevator improvements is lower than we thought it would be. This will allow PERF dollars to go further than we expected. So while we may preserve fewer units, it won't be as bad as it could have been with these anticipated elevator costs. The second reason that we propose a reduction from the preservation programs is because of the federal increase in the weatherization program. We've been working with the Department of Commerce, Office of Energy Security, to figure out ways that local weatherization providers can use their weatherization dollars on multifamily properties. Typically, it's only been used on single-family properties. Under ARRA, under the Stimulus Act, they receive 13 times the amount of money than typical. Typically, an annual appropriation was $10 million to the state. Under ARRA, it was $131.9 million. So that allows a lot of opportunities to increase what they're doing with their weatherization funds to not just assist low-income homeowners, but also low-income renters and properties that have low-income renters to ensure that we can preserve that affordable housing.
Can I just ask you a question? You have, as a bullet point there, that 75 fewer units will be preserved. Is that your estimate of what will be lost to project-based rental housing, or what actually does that represent?
Madam Chair, I'll get to the impact, but in shorthand, the 75 units is just under the rental rehab loan program, and the 336 would be, and I'll get to this in the presentation.
All right, I'll wait till you.
Okay. So I just want to show you one example. Representative Bly isn't here, but in Northfield, Three Rivers Community Action has been working with, and that's a local CAP agency that provides weatherization. They've been working with an affordable housing property that has tax credits for rehab, and they're actually stretching the tax credit dollars further, allowing us to have a smaller gap financing by bringing in weatherization to deal with the insulation and the air sealing and the furnace or boiler upgrade. So by using federal weatherization dollars, we can stretch both state dollars and other federal dollars further, like tax credits. And I just want to address two items. Last year, that the big reduction came out of challenge. We did not go there this year, one, because of that. And we do have some remaining in there. But as we described last year, the reason that we took from challenge or reduced challenge was because of the huge influx of funding from ARRA for tax credit gap financing. We've used more than $60 million in the past year to close the gaps on all 2007, 2008, 2009, and even some 2010 tax credit properties. This is huge. That money was very valuable. All those properties are now moving forward. Construction will be able to begin. Jobs will be created. So that was a huge benefit there. We're closing on the first ones there, and we anticipate construction to start in the next month or two on most of those. Now to the impact. And I just want to address that there is some left in challenge, but we're saving that for 2011 tax credit properties because, if they don't extend the tax credit gap financing from the federal government, we will need some of that extra tax credit gap financing there. So You see some remaining in challenge for 2010 in your spreadsheet, but it allows us to then fill the gaps next year that the federal dollars won't do. The impact of these budget recommendations will result in 336 fewer units preserved in 2010 and 2011 in the PARIF program. We determined that for every dollar of PARIF funding put into a property, we preserve about $5.70 of federal subsidy. So if each of these units that were not able to be preserved left the federal Section 8 program, $20.8 million in federal assistance would be lost. But we believe this is a worst-case scenario. Typically, many of these properties will defer their maintenance, or we may be able to find some other financing, but it will have a higher interest rate. So the 336 lost units is a worst-case scenario. We don't anticipate that all those would be lost, but that would be if every single one of those properties opted out of the Section 8 contract at the end of their year, and we didn't have any funding to help keep them in by preserving their property. And then the 75 units would be 75 fewer units would be preserved under the Rental Rehabilitation Loan Program. And this is an estimate based on previous per unit expenditures. I'm going to close with reminding you of how important state appropriations are to meeting our needs of low and moderate income Minnesotans. All state appropriated programs serve households below 50% of the statewide area median income, or $36,450 per household, with the exception of our down payment assistance program for first-time home buyers. The only way we're able to serve low-income households is through state appropriations. You know, we can issue bonds or we can do other loan financing, but you always have to pay that back. With state appropriations, we can serve the lowest incomes in our state and the neediest. The agency does not receive any funding from the state budget for its operations. So all the funding in our budget goes directly to serve the needs of low and moderate income Minnesotans. With that, I'll conclude, and I'd be happy to answer any of your questions.
Questions from committee members. Representative Howells, I think you had your hand up first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want you to redefine unit for me. When you say 36 units, is a unit a one-bedroom home, two-bedroom home, an apartment? How many people are just define unit again for me.
Ms. Blankenship.
Madam Chair, Representative Howes, a unit is typically, especially when you're talking about preservation, it's a household unit. So we're usually preserving apartments there. It's not typically there may be a few family townhomes that are rental properties, but by and large, they are apartment units.
Okay, so Madam Chair, just a quick follow-up. If you were to have a 20-unit apartment building, that would be 20 units?
Correct.
Okay.
All right,
good.
Just along that line, have you, since you're proposing this reduction that would potentially result in 336 units, have you figured out the distribution of where those units would be?
Madam Chair, it really depends on where contracts can expire all across the state. So it really just depends on where the property is.
Okay, but I'm sure you know you have a document that tells you when those various units expire, and you must have been looking forward to that. Can you share that information?
Madam Chair, we do know when contracts are expiring. All across the state, you have Section 8 project-based housing. So all across the state, you have contracts expiring in the next 5 years. It would have a statewide impact. I can't say for certain if it would be in Minneapolis or, you know, Duluth or Crookston.
Well, I'm guessing, though, that you do have some idea of some of those numbers, where they are in general, or I mean more specifically, because, again, they're expiring on an actual basis that you can look at them. So I'm sure somebody in your agency has looked at them. If they haven't, I would appreciate if you could. I think it would be really helpful to the members here to know where the units are that are going to be expiring and who's at risk with this recommendation. So,
Madam
can you provide that to us?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hayden?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Blankenship. I think Ms. Radke kind of answered my question. Sorry that I was late. I missed a little bit of your presentation. I do want to just talk about, it looks like your proposed cuts are in the PARIF and the rehab loan program over the next, this year and then in 2011. and you might have explained this, so if you have, excuse me, why there or and not maybe a more across-the-board approach to making those cuts?
Ms. Blankenship.
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, we felt that we have principles that are important to us with our budget. So last year when we presented our budget recommendations, we really wanted to protect the programs that serve the most vulnerable and continue progress on the business plan and long-term homelessness. And to the extent possible, protect programs that leverage non-state resources. Obviously, we weren't able to achieve all those with PARIF. It does leverage some non-state resources. But we really felt like we need to honor those commitments. And then we added a fourth one this year, was to honor the commitments that have already been made. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in Housing Trust Fund with rental assistance, we have commitments there that have been made for 10 and 11. We don't want to renege on those next year, and then someone who is counting on rental assistance doesn't have it. So we really tried to stick with our principles first instead of just doing an across-the-board cut, which would impact previously made commitments.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hayden.
Ms. Blankenship. I think I agree with those principles. Could you just speak a little more, and I know that I caught the tail end of this as I was walking in, about how much we lose in federal funds for the proposed PARIF cuts?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, it would be about $20.8 million, if every single unit that we weren't able to assist, and the per unit cost is about, I think, $10,900 typically for PARIF. So calculating that out with the cut, then that tells us that we lose $20.8 million on a $5.70 per unit. That's worst case scenario. We don't anticipate we would lose all that, but that would be if every single one of those 336 units opted out of Section 8.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hayden.
So that would be the match comes in the subsidy that comes from the Section 8 program, and so the worst case scenario would be that because they couldn't get they felt like they couldn't get the money from us to do the loan rehab, that they would in turn opt out of Section 8 as a whole, and then just return to the market, if you will.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Blankenship.
Just along the line of that question, I'm wondering how that fits with your first priority of protecting the most vulnerable, because it seems like the people in Section 8 are pretty vulnerable people. We have a lot of persons with very, very low incomes, disabilities, sometimes no income. How does it fit with that priority?
Madam Chair, certainly we serve very vulnerable people all across in many of our programs. Our lowest incomes are, for example, in Bridges and Housing Trust Fund, and then you get up to the Section 8 incomes. So it's just a little bit less, you know, the incomes aren't quite as low in that program. But I think we adhered to our principles, but we also had a rationale that there are some other sources of funding, such as weatherization, that can be brought into these project-based Section 8 units. Actually, today, a rule goes into effect that will release a list from the federal government of all the assisted properties that are income eligible for weatherization. So this will, a weatherization provider can look at it and say, these are all the properties in my territory that I don't have to go to every tenant and get them to sign up for weatherization. This building by right can be weatherized. So that's a huge step forward in the weatherization program that hasn't ever happened. And we're optimistic that this will allow us to get more of these, you know, PARIF eligible units weatherized, which will reduce the demand on PARIF.
Well, just to check a little bit further on that, you did mention Bridges and so on and homelessness, but you didn't mention the Challenge Fund, and that is certainly a much, you know, higher income, and it's also, there's a balance in there. What is the balance again that's left?
I think it's $3.4 million, Madam Chair. I can confirm it's on your handout.
$3.4 million uncommitted or?
Sorry, Madam Chair, on slide 6, you see unobligated amounts for fiscal year 10 is $3.9 million. And the reason that we didn't take from Challenge is one, because of the reduction from last year that already sustained a reduction for fiscal years 10 and 11. And because we had all this tax credit funding that moved all the tax credit projects forward for 7, 8, 9, and part of 10, which that $60 million really reduced the demand, obviously, on Challenge for tax credit gap financing. And so we look at this amount as helping for next year's tax credit projects to fill that gap. because we likely won't have the federal dollars next year to fill those gaps. So that's why we left that alone.
Your belief is that we won't have the federal dollars next year?
Madam Chair, at this point, there's no plan for an extension for the TCAP or exchange funding.
Okay.
It doesn't mean it wouldn't happen. But.
So nevertheless, the challenge fund would be above the, in terms of vulnerability, that would be a less needy group or less vulnerable group.
Madam Chair, it does reach higher incomes than most all of our other programs, aside from down payment assistance.
Okay, I just thought it might be important for us to think about that. Mm-hmm. Representative Benson, I think you're
right. Thank you, Madam Chair. When I was in the K-12 Finance Committee, a discussion about the stimulus bill funding for education came up, and I asked a question as to whether the department had an estimate on how many jobs were either saved or created because of the funding from the federal government. And the estimate that the department came up with was somewhere between 6,000 and 7,000 jobs. Now, your department has received stimulus funding as well, and also the funding that the state of Minnesota has appropriated. I'm just wondering if you have any estimate as to how many jobs you had mentioned, for example, that there are a number of projects about ready to get going. And I'm just wondering, since we're all very interested in job creation, one of the big debates concerning the bonding bill that we have before the legislature and the governor concerns creation of jobs. I'm just wondering if your department could give us an estimate, if you have it, as to how many jobs have been preserved or will be created by either the stimulus funding from the federal government or state appropriations.
Ms. Blankenship.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, regarding the stimulus funding, the TCAP and exchange funds, which are for tax credit projects, they have to report on the jobs that are created. Like I said, most of those are just getting going, so they haven't reported yet. I think we had one project that reported two jobs at this point, but obviously there will be hundreds that come from those projects. Regarding projections on loss of jobs due to these reductions, I think we presented last year on the economic impact of Minnesota Housing's investments.
Yes.
And under this, under rehab, it says that for every million, 15 jobs are created. So if you take the 4.6 million cut, it would be about 70 jobs that would not be created because of these reductions.
Madam Chair, if I may just follow up, just for the comment to the committee and those who might be listening. I find it interesting that we're having this struggle with the federal government to find ways to stimulate the economy, but in many of the states, in spite of the stimulus support that they have been receiving from the federal government, which if they hadn't gotten it would have made things much worse, are generally passing budgets which in effect will be counterproductive to the federal effort to increase job placements. And I just, Madam Chair, I just find that unfortunate.
Representative Benson. Representative Severson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, you know, we're always in the mode, particularly in this committee, of taking care of the poor and the most vulnerable. Part of this process, I think, is always painful in trying to determine which are going to be the least affected. And I wanted to find out, Deputy Commissioner, on the reductions that have been made here, these are on the base, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Severson, that is correct.
And this is in response to the unallotment, so these would be permanent on the base going out. So would this stabilize the housing that we currently have after this cut has been made? We would be able to pretty much stay even after this.
Ms. Blankenship.
Madam Chair, Representative Severson, you mean stabilize our budget and that we won't need to cut more? I'm sorry, can you clarify?
Yeah, I guess I'm being a little cryptic here. What I'm trying to find out is, you know, we're taking a $2 million cut per year on the biennium, and this is based on the priorities that you have put out, which I think are the correct priorities, and that we are trying to create some flexibility in the challenge and the bridge, which are taking care of a lot of the vulnerable, the mentally challenged, and some of the other ones. And so I think in this process, with the monies that are going out to the PERF, we're actually cutting that in this program, and this would go out in the base in the future years in 12 and 13. Is that the vision here?
Ms. Blankenship.
Madam Chair, Representative Severson, at this point, the cut would come out of PERF and rehab loan, but I think what would be make the most sense would be next year to come back to the committee when we have our 2012-13 budget and make sure these priorities still make sense. Maybe there's a new crisis that needs to be addressed, and maybe we'd rearrange where those cuts would come from. I don't think we can say for certain where it would come from in 12 and 13, but at this point, it's based on those numbers, yes. But I do think it would be reasonable and rational for us in the committee to look at next year where, you know, given this lower base, you know, are these still the two programs that should sustain a cut, or do you move things around?
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to Representative Benson's issue, I agree wholeheartedly. The jobs are an important process. I mean, that's what both sides of the aisle are working towards. I guess the issue here is to determine what are sustainable jobs. When you go with one-time funding for AARA monies, are those going to be for and the weatherization being one of those? And I know in my district, the weatherization has employed a considerable amount of people at the state level to implement those dissemination of those dollars. But those are going to go away once the AARA dollars are gone. And so I guess the issue needs to be, how do we stimulate the business sector, the private sector, to actually keep some sustainable dollars coming in? And I think those are the debates that we need to have on the House floor in terms of what jobs are we creating, and are they actually sustainable jobs? Are they jobs that are going to carry us forward so that we do have tax revenue that's coming in that can supplement some of the things that we're trying to do here for our low-income and most vulnerable? And that's a discussion, good discussion. Thank you.
Representative Benson, I think to that point.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We needn't go into a philosophical debate on all these things at this point. I think we both agree on the importance of long-term job creation in the private sector. But you know, John Maynard Keynes, who was the guy that convinced Roosevelt et al. To do the New Deal, it was never designed, as you could see from history, to have this to be some kind of a permanent jobs-creating thing. But Keynes one time said, when his critics were arguing that the federal government ought not to be spending money to try to get the economy back on the track, they would say things like, well, you know, eventually the economy will pick up. And he agreed with that, and he said, yes, but eventually we'll all be dead, too, because we need a bridge to get from where we are now until the private sector is able to take its place again in the demand structure. And that's the issue. I don't think any of these bills, the stimulus bill at the federal level or what we're trying to do with the bonding bill, is meant to be some long-term solution or replacement for the private sector. It is simply to assist the private sector to recover so that we can get back to where we were in the 70s, 80s, and part of the 90s.
Okay, with that, you're welcome. I want to go on to let a couple of more people participate. Representative McNamara, you had a comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Blankenship, my question centers around the ARA funding for weatherization, and I know it's a little bit out of the scope of your agency, but having sat through those discussions when we had them at conference committee, there was a lot of discussion about that we were going to have a hard time spending all that money, that we weren't going to be able to find enough homes to get weatherized. And this morning I heard on the radio that Minnesota is substantially behind. Originally we were getting awarded for doing a good job, and then we come to find out, which I think is more consistent with what we were told back last year in session, that it was going to be hard to spend that money. Are none of these units that you're talking about, are they not, was there not flexibility in that federal program? And I remember when we did the state legislation, we tried to give the agency flexibility to move some of that weatherization money from one part to the other, but we were limited by the feds in how much we could move it around. Is none of the ARA money that we're having trouble spending available to work on these units?
Ms. Blankenship, do you care to respond to that?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative McNamara. All of the weatherization money is available to be used on PERF-eligible units. It is up to the local weatherization provider. There's roughly 32 across the state. And it's up to them to decide what properties they weatherize. As long as the household meets the income guidelines, which is about 200% of poverty, roughly $40,000 per household, depending on household size. Whether it's a rental unit or a homeownership unit, they are eligible for weatherization if they meet the guidelines and an energy audit determines that they have energy efficiency needs. So they, yes, got an award. They were in the top five for production of at the early stage for the statewide Office of Energy Security, but I understand that their average per unit is lower, and that's why they're not spending as much money as possible. So we did think that multifamily is a great way to, you know, you do 100 units right at once. That's 100 households. You can get a lot of money out the door quickly and not only conserve energy but help preserve affordable housing across the state. There was some concern that, you know, you're enriching landlords if you have rental housing. Well, with affordable rental housing, landlords aren't making a lot of money. They've got caps on their rents. They've got caps on their reserves. This really would help preserve affordable housing across the state if more weatherization providers would do more multifamily properties. And like I said, as of today, there's supposed to be a list coming out that lists all the income-eligible properties in the state, and pretty much all the project-based Section 8 properties, which PERF helps, should be on that list. So a provider can look at the list and say, oh, all these properties in my area, I can just go out and talk to the owner, and they can get weatherized without having to knock on every tenant's door. So we're hopeful that will move more weatherization dollars quickly to multifamily.
Representative McNamara?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. So if I'm understanding you right, and I thought there was flexibility, and I thought after the earlier discussion maybe there wasn't. So the reality, your second bullet point about where $20.8 million would be lost in federal assistance under Section 8, the reality, that's not happening to that extent, because my understanding is we don't even know if we can use all this federal money. We may end up in the end be sending it back. That was the testimony we had in on the conference committee at the time last year. And I guess you're coordinating with it was the Commerce Department, mm-hmm. if I'm not mistaken. So you've worked with them and had discussions with them about how that money could be used. And so is that some of the rationale for why you went to this program and, look, we're not even sure if we're going to be able to use all that federal money. We should use that. Am I following that right? So it seems like it. I agree that Section 8 is important. And the reality, a lot of these tenants pay their own utility bill. So sometimes it may take a federal program or something to push the landlord to weatherize it, because it's tenant saving the money and he or she is worried more about their bottom line and not necessarily about the tenants. So the federal program, is it more generous sometimes than what your program was?
Ms. Blankenship.
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, right now the maximum per unit cost that weatherization can incur per unit is $6,500 on average. There is a savings to investment ratio. You know, typically windows can't be done because their payback is too long. So it's best to kind of pair weatherization with some other funds if you want to try to get to things like the roof and the windows. And weatherization can deal with the boiler, the furnace, and the air sealing and the insulation.
Okay.
So it is less typically than PERF spends per unit.
Representative Hayden, I think we'll have the last comment or question, and then we're going to move on to the health department so we have time to hear from them.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mrs. Blankenship. I was just listening to Representative Stevenson as he was, I think, wisely trying to figure out if this is the right mix, if this is the right, are we cutting in the right place over time, and will that stabilize it? And I thought that I heard you say, and I wanted to kind of reiterate, that essentially there is a backlog on this, on these issues, period. So what we're currently spending doesn't anywhere meet the need. And so I think it's wise to say we have to figure out, per what we have to do today, where we need to cut. And I don't necessarily disagree with where the agency has stated where they want to start, but I do think that we're just going to come back and we just dig a deeper hole with, for instance, what we do for PERF and rehab loan, and then they may get to a point where we may have to rearrange what we need to do and then put more money into those programs if they hit a critical level. And I also want to comment on you kind of said it, but this idea that weatherization and then to be in combination with the PERF may get the bang for the buck, but they do different things and they have different guidelines. So the weatherization money that is coming in is definitely going to help, but it doesn't cover all of the same things that the PAIRF program may cover. So I think my closing statement is that, you know, this is very, very tough stuff, and we most certainly have to make some decisions. But even as it relates to this fixation, if you will, about jobs, and I call it a fixation because we all think about it differently. We think about it, how many jobs we get, how sustainable they are they over the long term? But in particular in this committee, one of the things that we're charged to do is to make sure that people have a safe, affordable, stable place to live. And so to that extent that we can put it in a jobs context, I'm all for. But the underlying bottom line, in my opinion, and what I hear is the charge of the agency and our charge, is to make sure that we have an affordable place for people to live so that their children can grow up healthy and that they can go to the same schools, and that hopefully that then they can go on and enter the marketplace in a way that they can be productive citizens. So I probably, you know, for me, I'm just starting to get to that point where I think we need to really take a good look at what are we here for, and make sure that we're doing that as well as all of the things that we say that we want to do in terms of creating jobs. And if the jobs are, well, I know Representative Downey on the floor had a graph that I couldn't even figure out, but he was making some sort of point about if these are real jobs or not real jobs. Well, the reality is that somebody's going to work on these units and make them safe for our children.
Thank you. Just on the jobs issue, I'll just end maybe with a question and a comment. Speaking of jobs, because of these cuts we made at the agency, will there be some jobs lost, or what kind of staffing changes will there be in regard to these cuts at the agency?
Madam Chair, while none of our operating costs come from the state budget, we have voluntarily looked for ways to take reductions and to not fill vacant positions, for example. So that's been the way that we've saved some costs on the agency side, but there's no direct impact on this budget reduction.
Okay. I'm just wondering, I know you showed earlier the job study that was done last year, and I'm just wondering if you might make that available to the committee. I think it's a good document, and we can make sure all committee members get that. It basically talks about when we do housing, what kind of jobs are created, and what's returned to the tax, to the revenue department, and so on. So it's my take on that is that creating jobs through housing is a very very good thing to do. We create a lot of jobs when we deal with both repairing and make building new housing. So if you can share that, that would be great.
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to.
Thank you. Members, we're going to move on right now because we want to get through the Health Department presentation. Thank you very much, Ms. Blankenship, for coming. And we'll hear from the Health Department now. And I believe there's bars to be passed around. We want to not send them home with Christine. I think they need to go that way. Again, members, this is we're hearing again about the governor's proposed cuts to both the housing and the health agencies. And I just want to invite any of you who have strong recommendations to the chair about what we should be recommending to please speak to me. I will be making some final choices based on your final recommendations, I should say, based on your recommendations. Probably today. So if you have some strong thoughts, please let me know. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity today to come and present the governor's budget recommendations for the Minnesota Department of Health. For the record, my name is Craig Akam. I'm assistant commissioner at the department. And with me today is Barb Julek, our chief financial officer. As a reminder today, before we go through some change pages, which hopefully all of you have, that would look like this. Our budget jurisdiction for the Department of Health is split between two finance committees, this one and Representative Huntley's committee. We will only be talking about the budget items that affect the Department of Health as related to this committee's jurisdiction today. And so before we start going through our changes, I do want to mention that, as all of you know, these are unprecedented financial times, both for our state and our state budget. We had a number of reductions here that we might not normally have offered in other times, and the fact that they are offered here is no indictment on their need, criticalness, or effectiveness. But we were asked, as were all state agencies, to participate in a budget solution. And within the framework that we were given to work within, these are some of our best recommendations. And so with that, I think we'll get started. And I'll ask Ms. Julich to walk through the changes on the change pages.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Barb Julich from the Department of Health. Our first change page deals with grant eliminations. On this page, there are two grant eliminations. However, only one pertains to this committee. It is the general fund reduction for $25,000 a year to the lead-based grant program. This program provides costs related to the temporary relocation of families to safe housing while lead abatement is taking place. Typically, this grant goes to one or two grantees, local grantees, who also receive federal lead grants for the same activity. So this would just eliminate the state funding for this activity, but the federal money would remain. Moving on to the next page.
Mr. Julich, maybe I'll just ask you a question since we're there. Do you happen to know if the federal dollars that are coming in meet the need for this program?
I'll bring Commissioner Stein to answer. Mm-hmm.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Stein, Assistant Commissioner with the Department of Health for Health Protection, and you asked a question related to the federal HUD dollars that the communities receive. We have their 2009 entitlement grants for community development block grant funds in Hennepin County were $2.426 and change million dollars. Minneapolis receives roughly $3.4 million in community development block grant funds, and St. Paul receives roughly $8 million in community block grant funds. In addition, the Recovery Act provided additional grant funds to St. Paul, Hennepin County, Minneapolis last year in relatively proportional amounts, but starting at around $650,000 for Hennepin County, $3.6 million for Minneapolis, and $2.1 million for St. Paul. So those dollars are used by the communities, can be used by the communities for lead relocation expenses.
Thank you. What about Greater Minnesota? What kind of resources are there out there? If members aren't familiar with this, when a home has children who are poisoned by the lead in them, often the families are required to move out while that repair is being done. And these dollars paid for the relocation of those families into other temporary housing so that housing could be made lead safe. And so I'm just wondering, what you indicated, I heard you say, was the CDBG dollars in the metropolitan area, or at least Hennepin and Ramsey counties?
Correct.
What about Greater Minnesota?
Madam Chair, the funds that were the subject of this reduction were only eligible in the metropolitan area for those communities that I listed. So the other funds for other communities around the state that they receive in assistance for remediation of lead in homes remains unaffected by the governor's recommendations.
So are you saying, Mr. Stein, that there is a separate pot for the metro area as compared to Greater Minnesota for the lead relocation?
For relocation funds, Madam Chair, yes. These funds were eligible for the metropolitan area.
And what is the, if you could, wouldn't mind giving me the dollar figure for the two different pots of funding?
If you don't
have it today, you could get it to us.
I will get your response on that, Madam Chair, okay. But I don't believe we have a separate pot of money that we use for relocation grants.
Well, if you don't have a separate pot, what is available to Greater Minnesota for? What is the amount that's available to you?
I'll get you that.
That's what you're going to get us. Okay.
Chair.
All right. Thank you.
Because
we do have childhood lead poisoning throughout the state. We know that.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, the next page deals with our administrative budget reduction. The governor is recommending all agencies take a 3% administrative reduction across all state appropriated funds. In addition to this, the governor is also recommending in the state agency budget an additional 3% on top of this that will be prorated to agencies after they look at certain efficiencies with infrastructure and administrative activities. This page only deals with that first 3% that has already been allocated to the agencies within the governor's budget. The department would propose certain changes to absorb, or not absorb, to take effect the 3% reduction. In fiscal year 10, we had a lot of federal money that we were able to shift staff to through the H1N1 federal funds we received, and were able to generate some one-time salary savings in the general fund. We've also had a hiring freeze in our state funds for a number of months that we have been able to generate some salary savings. And so for fiscal year 10, we were proposed a $600,000 reduction to our general fund administrative budget based on those one-time salary savings from either holding vacancies or shifting to H1N1 activities last fall. Beginning in fiscal year 10, we would need to implement position reductions and activity reductions to meet an ongoing 3%, which would be about $400,000 in fiscal year 11, and then $667,000 ongoing. These reductions would amount to about 3.5 FTEs beginning in fiscal year 11, and those FTEs would be in the cancer area, diabetes, obesity, or activities affected would include cancer control activities, diabetes, obesity, and chemical health activities, air quality, food safety, disease surveillance, lab maintenance would be some examples where we would have position reduction and activity reduction due to these ongoing reductions. The Healthcare Access Fund reduction also represents a 3%, and that is part of Representative Huntley's committee. I will not go through that at this point in time, but there are also FTE reductions associated with that. Within the State Government Special Revenue Fund, the numbers represent a 3% reduction. About half of that reduction is in this committee, so $700,000 the first year and $350,000 in the second year would fall into this committee's jurisdiction, and it would deal with continuing to hold vacancies or phase in hires from last year's appropriations in some of the fee programs through the lab and some of the fee programs through health, environmental health. And those would be one-time savings again, maintaining vacancies, phasing in some of the appropriations from last year, but just for one time in the state government special revenue fee program.
Well, since you're there, why don't we give you a chance to talk about what will not get done in each of those agencies as a result of those cuts?
In the general fund, Madam Chair? Or?
Yeah, let's start with the ones that affect this, that relate to this committee.
Madam Chair, we don't know exactly how those cuts will be allocated, but I think it's safe to say that the Department of Health will do less. As this committee probably recalls, the Department of Health took an 8% administrative budget reduction at the end of last session, which was the largest by percentage of budget of any state agency. We then took another 2.5% on allotment following that, and this represents another 6% reduction to our state agency budget. That's almost an 18% reduction in less than a year. The Department of Health has been able to stave off some layoffs because we have been able to secure federal funding for our H1N1 pandemic response. But that is coming to a close as well, and the staff that we shifted over to maintain our agency's capacity will also be running out of funding shortly. And so we expect that we will have substantially less staff, and we will be able to do substantially less across all of our program areas as outlined on this change page in terms of general areas where those reductions may happen.
Thank you. I'm just wondering if you'd be a little more specific. So, for example, cancer control. Now, I know we haven't done the colon cancer screening. I guess that's going to now be released. Those dollars have been waiting until, I guess, the governor made his recommendations, which I'm interested to know a little bit how that works. What other programs were held, monies were held, waiting for the governor's budget from last year's allocations? That's one thing. But let's just look at the first one you've got here, cancer control. What are we not going to do in terms of cancer control?
Madam Chair, currently we have a vacancy in that area, and that position would be continued to be held vacant and not filled, allowing the savings generated to meet these needs.
Okay, and so what's not being done because that vacancy is there?
Madam Chair, I think that it would reduce our efforts across a wide range of health promotion and chronic disease activities. And we will lose capacity to pursue specific programs related to diabetes, in Native American populations. We will lose capacity to continue to do surveillance on cancer across the state. We will lose capacity to support our efforts in the colorectal and breast screening programs. I mean, there are a lot of we will need to do less based on this budget, as will all state agencies. These are dramatic times for the state budget, and it will require a downsizing in programs and activities, and we can't continue to do as much as we have. The other critical factor I think that this committee should know about related to our general fund budget is that it's mainly what is left here is used as our match and maintenance of effort for our federal funds. The largest percentage of our budget comes from federal sources, and we're able to secure that money because we are able to put state funds as a match and provide an administrative overstructure or oversight in order to bring those dollars into the state and implement programs. And so I don't think that we can stand here or sit here today and give you specific examples of what specific programs will have in terms of specific reductions, but I think that it's safe to say that this represents a general decline in terms of the services that the department can perform. And it's a necessary one given the current budget situation.
Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair, and either Mr. Aiken or Ms. Julek, and I'm not trying to be critical here because I'm just trying to understand where you account for these things. I think on Friday we got a memo from management and budget about the state getting over a two-year period about $130 million in federal grants, and a big chunk of which went to the health department. Mm-hmm. How does that get accounted in here? Yeah, I mean, obviously you get a grant, you're supposed to do something very specific with that. But how do you account for the, does that show up on the budget that we see, or is it separate?
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, it shows up separately. We're just talking about changes in our state funding for the department. And in particular, this is our administrative budget. A lot of the federal grants we get, over two-thirds of the money the Department of Health receives as part of its overall budget, goes out in the form of grants and support to our partners. And a lot of the federal stimulus money and even the federal H1N1 response money followed that same pattern. And so this is the money that the department has to, in essence, administer those grant programs, to provide the program oversight, to provide the training and technical assistance, to make sure that those programs act in an efficient and coordinated fashion, and then to pool the results and do the performance measuring and all the things that are expected of the department in terms of maintaining a high level of transparency and public accountability for those programs.
Representative Huntley.
Madam Chairman and Mr. Aikum, if is the administrative costs that you are required to do, is that money that's in the grant to subsidize the department, or is this something you just have to do yourself?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, in some cases, there are dollars that come with a federal grant for staffing at the department to do that. In other cases, there are not. And so it's mixed depending on what the grant is, and the match and maintenance of effort requirements vary as well, grant to grant.
Okay. Other questions?
Well, Madam Chair, if I could just add one more. I mean, I congratulate the department for getting those grants. It was quite some money.
Well, as a matter of fact, along that line, I know we asked for some detail on the grants that had come in, and I think what we received was not quite the detail. And I'm wondering, I think I'll look here as we're talking. I know we got some information from you, but I am very interested, because I think you've been quite successful in getting certain grants that deal with certain areas. So for example, you mentioned environmental health, and there's the issue of air quality and all of that. So if I could have the details of those breakdown of those dollars, that would be really helpful, the federal dollars. I think I must not have asked it clearly enough in our meeting the other day. You know, the kind of grants that you've been able to bring in.
And Madam Chair, I think you're just asking for some detail on what federal grants the department has.
Yeah, what are they? What are
Madam
the
Chair, we can provide you a current listing of all our active federal grants.
I think that would be helpful because when we look at the issue of food safety, and you mentioned the H1N1, so infectious diseases, that was apparently very helpful, but there's other really basic kinds of health and safety issues here that we need to know whether or not some of what you've applied for and received goes to those other areas or not. Thank you.
Madam Chair, the next page is a clarification page regarding some of our fee programs. There are two changes being requested here. The first change would be in regard to our youth camp fees. As you recall, last year we did establish a licensing fee for youth camps. In doing so, the language needs to be clarified that if you are licensed, if there are about 25 youth camps that also fall under licensing for food and lodging, and this would just clarify that you would only pay the food and lodging fee and not also the youth camp fee. And in doing so, we estimate a reduction in revenue because we're not obviously charging for both fees. The second clarification would be in the manufactured home parks and recreational camping area, very similar. There are two potential base fees that they could fall under, and it's just clarifying that they would fall under either the manufacturing and recreation area base fee or the base fees under Section 157.16, which include food and beverage services, youth camps, hotels, motels, lodging, and public pool or resort. So it's just clarifying that you'd only fall under one fee.
Representative Howes isn't here. He had made a major role in talking about that last year, so maybe we'll make sure that he looks at this information. Thank you.
Madam Chair, the last budget page we have is the governor's recommendation to continue the unallotments that were implemented last summer for this biennium into the fiscal year 12 and 13 tails. So this budget page, just as for information, outlines what those unallotments were. And the recommendation would take the fiscal year 11 unallotments and then continue them into 12. So for this committee, it would primarily fall under the number two items in this budget page, the redesigning of activities. The unallotment would continue the reductions in the Minnesota Children and Special Health Needs reduction of $355,000. We would work on our current work on healthcare homes will hopefully incorporate some of these activities so that we can better coordinate the service for children within this unallotment. Also included in this would be an ongoing $74,000 reduction in environmental health. Many of these activities that were being unallotted were shifted to fee activities last year. So this is just eliminating the general fund sources for those activities. And the final item that's part of this committee would be an administrative reduction of $22,000. This would be toward gaining efficiencies in our administrative support for our field offices. We run 8 district offices, and we would look to create some efficiencies within those offices. And so this, again, proposal would be continuing those fiscal 11-year unallotments into fiscal 12 and 13 for a total of $525,000. As Mr. Acom mentioned, that represents about 2.25% of our base at the end of last session. That's on top of the 8% reduction, and the 3% reduction here would be on top of that, and the governor's 3% would be on top of that, getting to around 17%.
Question, comments from committee members? Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair Clark. And just when you mention efficiencies in those other offices, can you give me some specifics about what that means? What's going to make them more efficient?
Madam Chair, Representative Bly, the governor's proposal for the final 3% reduction across all state agencies was meant to first get at efficiencies that might not be available to an agency itself. Those are system efficiencies, working primarily with the Office of Enterprise Technology, the Department of Administration, Minnesota Management and Budget, looking to those agencies if there's any efficiencies that can be created for all state government, all state agencies first. And then whatever isn't reached in terms of a target would then be distributed out to the remaining state agencies as an administrative cut to their budgets.
Madam Chair, Representative, in terms of your specific question for this $22,000, you know, I think we're looking at staffing levels. We're looking at how we purchase things, how we order things, how we inventory things. you know, the budget itself for that area is not very large. It's around $100,000. This is quite the reduction for it, but it's, again, looking just at the administrative support offered to the field service staff and how we operate that.
Representative Blythe.
I'm all for making things more efficient. I guess I'm sensitive, though, to, I mean, we're in this economy. A lot of times, the most efficient thing we can do is to lay people off, mm-hmm. and you know, we're creating a larger problem for the unemployed, and that causes me concern. And you know, I mean, these aren't necessarily temporary jobs. These were considered permanent jobs, and they're going to be lost, and people will be out looking for work, competing for work that other people are already competing for. I'm very concerned and conscious of the fact that we don't want to add to our unemployed lists. And you know, you mentioned that, and I'm assuming from what you said, Commissioner, that these aren't frivolous things. These aren't wasteful things that you're spending money on. You're providing services that are important and ought to be provided. But as you say, in these economic times, we have to tighten our belts. But there are other things we could do. I mean, I recognize there's not a real appetite to raise revenue, but and certainly we probably couldn't raise enough revenue to save all of the departments of government that we might like to. But you know, the impression that I get from some constituents who say, oh yeah, you can cut and cut and cut, and there's lots of waste, I don't see that happening. That's not what I'm hearing from people. I'm hearing that there will be losses of services, there will be things that departments are no longer able to do that were important for people. This also concerns me because I have interest in how the middle class gets served, and I see over and over again things that serve our middle class and help them are the things that are going away, whether it's road transportation or, you know, I mean, people who don't get the roads fixed for themselves, this isn't your concern, but they're going to be paying more money out of pocket to get their cars repaired as they, you know, fall into this pothole or that pothole. I'm wondering when we're going to reach that point where we realize that maybe we do need to raise some more revenue. And I guess I'd like to see that revenue based on people who are employed right now and probably have maybe done well in this economy, rather than passing that expenditure on to people who maybe have lost their jobs, but they're going to see their property taxes go up. So it all is very concerning to me. I appreciate your coming before us and letting us know that what we're going to be losing, but it's not good news for us.
Thank you. Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I had the same concerns about, you know, what are the efficiencies. So I'll just elaborate on what, or ask you to elaborate, rather, on his concern. I'm thinking about, you know, when you're looking at efficiencies with regard to regional programs that you have, are you able to consider the fact that oftentimes there's kind of an intangible efficiency to having regional staff in place that is very well versed in working with their community, with that regional area, and can actually save money, can save time simply because they know what to do, who to talk to, and it not only saves money for the department, but saving money for all those other entities that they are working with. So I'm wondering, you know, are those kind of intangible things considered as well? Because I do know, and I've certainly heard from a number of folks, that when a regional office is closed or there's less staffing or whatever, and they have to deal with St. Paul, it takes just about as much time, and it's not necessarily a savings because, you know, costs go up in other areas of just how many times you have to be back and forth, how much clarification, all of those situations. So I'm just wondering how you're considering that aspect in the efficiencies.
Mr. Aiken.
Madam Chair, Representative Saylor, we're certainly looking at all of those effects. If it doesn't necessarily save us money to close an office and have to have staff drive farther, you know, maybe that's a wash. I think that when we look at our overall operation, we're going to look at, you know, what are our core essential local public health functions, what is the best way that we can continue to deliver as many of them as possible, most efficiently and effectively as possible. And, you know, we're going to take into account a number of factors, but primarily at the end of the day, we have to work within our means. And cost is going to be a major issue. And, you know, the bottom line is that as a state agency, you know, we are responsible for carrying out the statutory intent and regulatory authority that we have vested in us by you and the people of Minnesota, but we also have to do that within the financial means that we have available and then the resources that are at our disposal. And so those are going to be challenges that we and every other state agency are going to face in coming through this financial deficit and working on a solution together. But it's going to mean something different. We can't continue to do business as we usually have.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just wondering, with the downturn in the economy and so forth, it seems like maybe that also might create less demand for some of the services. And one of those areas I'm wondering is perhaps, does it fall under your purview, the Department of Health, the inspections of restaurants and that sort of thing? I know there are a lot fewer of those popping up. In fact, I heard a statistic last week that there's a restaurant per week in the state of Minnesota going out of business. So I'm wondering if that has affected the number of inspectors that you need, or if you've had to lay off folks in that area, or if they've been absorbed in another area, just out of curiosity. Thank you.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Scott, you know, that's a fair question. You know, I would just remind the committee that many of our regulatory activities are funded on fees by the regulated communities. And so as we inspect restaurants, we charge those restaurants a fee for us to do that inspection service. And so as there are less restaurants, we are also getting less revenue. And so we do balance our programs in terms of staffing and effort based on the size and scale and scope of the programs. But as the economy goes down, we've certainly decreased our efforts in certain areas. And as the economy has gone down, the demand has increased in other areas. And so, you know, we continually balance those forces in our budget and in our operations.
I just wanted to follow that up by just saying thank you that you understand this whole concept that we can't continue on the road that we're on. Things are drastically going to change, and I appreciate your understanding that those changes have to be made whether we like it or not. It's going to be painful in many cases, and I appreciate your understanding that with your agency. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else? I just wanted to ask a question. There's a couple of things. One of the things that you talk about is agency-wide reprioritizing of non-critical activities. So I'm wondering if you could just indicate which of your activities do you consider non-critical? Because when I look at the list of what's going to be cut, cancer, diabetes, obesity, chemical health, air quality, food safety, infectious disease, lab maintenance, I don't know which of those are non-critical. Maybe you could help me get clearer on that. And then the other one is temporary refinancing of activities. What does that mean? Is there something here that we could learn about how you're going to do that?
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, I believe you're referring to the unallotment of $366,000 for fiscal year 10. This was achieved through, again, delaying certain vacancy hires and the ability to move toward other funding sources such as H1N1 federal funding or ERA funding. You know, I believe the word non-critical, I suppose critical is your definition of relative definition of critical. We would view all our activities as important and needed, but at some point there's a line that you draw, and that was what was drawn to meet the $366,000.
Madam Chair, this same word choice was brought up in Senator Berglund's committee, and we apologize. I wouldn't describe any of our current programs as non-critical. They're all critical, and they have varying degrees of importance. And so, you know, the Department of Health, as many other state agencies, have seen a long decline over the last decade of funding revenue. We've been very fortunate lately to have gotten some additional federal funding in the form of stimulus funds, H1N1 response funds, And so when we talk about refinancing, we mean moving staff over to those new funding sources, but only temporarily. None of those are permanent funding sources. All of those will wrap up in the next year or so. And in terms of non-critical, you know, I think that this is just about, again, us making choices in terms of what are most important of all of our critical functions that we want to maintain, that maybe have the broadest scope or the most important need or the greatest impact to the population of Minnesota.
Well, that's why we really need that list of what you have brought in terms of federal funds by category and what they cover. And I think we have to try to balance that too. You know, if you're getting dollars in one area federally, we just need to know for sure. And then I think the other question I had asked was also private funding that you've received from sources other than the federal government.
Right. And
other,
sure,
other than fees.
Correct. And other than state funding, I assume.
Yes.
We receive very little of that, though there are some private foundation grants that we do receive, the largest being generally from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, who's done a lot of work on health reform, both nationally and here in Minnesota. They've helped to fund some efforts that have complemented the work that we are doing under the 2008 state health reform legislation, and some of the work that we are also involved in involving health information technology.
Any others?
You know, those are the most significant ones, Madam Chair. You know, the others are small, generally $50,000 or less special projects that are from various groups. I would say that the largest amount of money we used to get was from the Susan G. Komen Foundation, but they have decided to reprioritize their spending and they no longer provide funding to the Department of Health.
Nevertheless, if they may seem small, we're talking about $25,000 reductions. I'd like to know, you know, what are we actually getting in, and maybe they add up to certain.
Right. And Madam Chair and committee members, you know, I think it's also important to mention that when we do receive grants from the federal government or otherwise, those are often very specified pots of money. They're very directed in their nature and their purpose. They're generally for a time-limited project, and they have very particular strings about how the money should be used and for what purposes.
Thank you, Mr. Akam. I'm aware of that, and I still want those numbers because we're really trying to help you figure out. I couldn't agree more that the Department of Health has taken a huge hit, and there's very critical services that you do. And we need to be aware of what options there are out there, and maybe even be supportive of federal grants that you're seeking in certain ways and so on. But I mean, it is distressing, for example, to know that you know, to read that cancer control can be one of the areas that is going to be cut more. I think of what happened with the colon cancer funding. It just sat there waiting for the governor's decision this time. If he had decided to unallot that, we wouldn't have that program going forward. And so I don't know what all the choices are that the department is making. I'm just asking you to be a little more, you know, forthcoming to help us figure out how to help you with some of these. I'm just looking at the area of obesity. You know, First Lady, I know, is interested in working with the federal government on obesity issues, and there's probably, I would guess, there might be some funding that might be coming forward that the department could apply for. It would just be helpful for us to know, you know, like, is that going forward? How can we think about that? And I think anything that has to do with actual health and safety issues, this committee is going to be very interested to hear about. We need you to be our watchdogs for that, and there are areas that are really critical in that regard. So I hope you won't be shy in talking with us about those, because we rely on you to help guard the public health and safety. Representative Huntley?
Madam Chair, you should be aware that it's in my budget area, but we had the State Health Improvement Act that we passed 2008, I think, that gives grants to local communities to fight obesity and tobacco. Mm-hmm. And the governor is proposing in the Healthcare Access Fund to eliminate $10 million of that one. out of the, I believe, 27 million that are still left. He wants to eliminate 10 million.
Since we're talking about,
I will fight that, of course.
Okay, thank you. Since we're talking about things in your committee, I was just going to mention too that I know the Office of Unlicensed Complementary and Alternative Healthcare is something that is in your committee, but I believe the fees, I'm not quite sure.
There are no fees.
Since they're unlicensed, there's no fees on the licensees. That's is an appropriated dollar, I believe, for that.
Madam Chair, as part of our general fund operating budget, yeah. That was unallotted.
I know that it was quite a effort to get that legislation passed by, you know, folks out in the community, and so I'm sure there'll be a lot of folks who are unhappy about that because that means, you know, if a person is accessing that type of health care, there's no place in that Department of Health to make a complaint. And my understanding is, I think in our conversations, they can just call the Attorney General's office, which certainly is not a full answer. What was your thinking about that and going ahead and allowing that to be removed?
Madam Chair, again, you know, these are times of difficult choices, and, you know, there's probably no choice that we would make that someone wouldn't feel the impact of. But in terms of the what has happened since the unallotment of the Office of Complementary and Alternative Practices, we did talk to Tom Hendelmeyer, who is our Health Occupations Program Manager, and he informs me that since the program was suspended, we have not received any complaints.
Okay. And when was that suspended?
As part of the governor's unallotment last June?
No.
August, I'm sorry. It would have
you haven't received any complaints, but then there's no one there to receive the complaints, right? I think that's not too surprising.
Well,
there's
Madam Chair, we do still take calls to that
I
program.
Okay.
And those calls are logged in an intake database.
Okay.
There have been 9 calls or contacts recorded since the program officially ceased operation at the end of August.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. Again, I see all of our Republican members have gone off somewhere, but those of you who are left, if you have any recommendations for me, I will be making some final recommendations or preliminary recommendations, I should say, to our leadership about these cuts that have been proposed and what we might propose as alternatives. So please talk to me right away after this committee if you can. Thank you very much for your testimony. I want to mention a couple things to committee members. We also within our jurisdiction are all the boards that I think you have a spreadsheet in your folder, and we've planned to have those boards come before us next week. Some of those boards are proposed to have cuts. The Disability Council, the Mental Health, Mental Retardation Ombudsman, the Families Ombudsman, the Emergency Medical Services Board. So we will try to have those boards come before us next week so we can see what the impact is that they anticipate with the governor's recommended cuts. I believe that'll be on Tuesday, yes. So, if you have some thoughts about any of those now, you can certainly talk to me about it. We have minutes from the previous meeting, February 17th. Representative Lane, have you had a chance to look at those?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, Representative Lane moves the adoption of the minutes from the last committee meeting. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the minutes are approved and adopted. Committee members, the meeting is adjourned.